Good evening, everyone. My name is Stephen Wolfolk. I am the Director of Programming at the Kansas City Public Library. And to be honest with you, it's been kind of an emotional night. That didn't really hit me until I started walking through the crowd a few minutes ago, and I realized that there's a lot of faces here that I haven't seen since what was probably the worst night of my professional life. And I count among those a night that I was arrested for defending a man's freedom of speech right down there. I'm not going to say a whole lot about that, but it is the elephant in the room, and those of you that were here, I think you deserve to hear something, so I'm going to say this. It's fitting, I think, that our friends at the Command and General Staff College are returning tonight for a series called Turning Points, because American democracy is at a turning point. Will we continue down this path on the left and the right of silencing dissenting opinions? Or will we turn to the American tradition of discourse to save this republic? I hope it is the latter. But that is not the turning point that brought you here tonight. You're here to learn about the Philippines, their role in the ascent of America to a position of world power, and their continuing importance today. And I cannot imagine a better person to give this talk than Jeff Babb. Retired U.S. Army Special Forces Lieutenant Colonel, Army Foreign Area Officer in China, Defense Intelligence Agency, Joint Staff in Washington, D.C. He earned his master's in East Asian Languages and Cultures and his doctorate in history from the University of Kansas. Please welcome our good friend, Jeff Babb.
So what does a China guy know about the Philippines? I got asked to write an article about the Philippines, and when I started to get into it, I visited there when I was doing my travels around the Pacific, and it's a fascinating place. Just show of hands, how many have been to the Philippines? Not as many as you might think. I found it a very, very interesting country. And I was at United States, what's now U.S. Indo-PACOM, when the Marcos regime collapsed. And I was in Hawaii when Mr. and Mrs. Marcos came to Hawaii. And now, as you'll see when I get to one of my last slides, the Marcoses are back. But what I'd like to do is to walk you through how we got there. And so most of tonight will be about 1898 to 1902. And then I have four or five slides at the end where we can start to creep from that period forward. So without special ado, I mean, I start with a Navy slide, which is probably not a good idea. I'll do another one. We went to war over the sinking of the Maine in Cuba. But there was an assistant secretary of the Navy by the name of T.R. Roosevelt who had set up the Navy in the Asiatic Pacific Theater to commence operations against the Spanish as soon as possible. And that's exactly what happened. And so it all starts with a naval battle in Manila Bay. What it leads to is almost 50 years of American colonization of the Philippines. And I'm going to walk through how we got there. What you can see here is McKinley, and then there's a great poem, Savage Wars of Peace by Rudyard Kipling, where a British poet welcomes the United States to imperialism, and specifically imperialism in Asia. And so, as it says down here, William Howard Taft, who you'll see has a history in the Philippines, says in 1905, we blundered into colonialization. I think Mark Twain would probably say something different. It was with malice of forethought that we went into the Philippines. Why malice of forethought? Because once we got to California, Manifest Destiny continued. and we continued to walk across the Pacific. Probably should have put on here that we opened Japan in 1854. But what you can see is this walk across the Pacific through the islands, where we, over the decades from essentially what the from the 1849 gold rush in California, over the next almost 50 years, we become a Pacific power. And this is basically how we do it. As you'll see later today, Guam is the key U.S. military base that we own in the Indo-Pacific. The problem with the Philippines is it is a terrible place to fight. And it's much bigger, as you can see, than most people would know. Now again, we're going to spend most of our time up on the island of Luzon, which is at the north. But we will fight throughout these islands. And you can see here the terrain. And the terrain is very difficult. But on the island of Luzon, you can look up north from Manila, and there's pretty much a plain down from Lingayen Gulf. That's not where we're going to start, but that's where the Japanese will start in 1941. So this is the Philippines, and hopefully it gives you an idea of the rugged terrain and the size. I'm going to talk about four campaigns. Actually, I will talk about four parts of one conflict. We're going to fight the Spanish, then we are basically going to fight the Spanish at sea, then the Spanish on land, then we're going to fight a conventional army that the Philippine people had put together to fight the Spanish, and then we're going to fight a guerrilla war. So through those 4 years, we will see some very interesting, what we would call campaigning. The Navy, of course, starts. Flagship USS Olympia in Hong Kong. When the Navy's in Hong Kong, we meet with a guy named Aguinaldo. And he gets the idea that when we take out the Spanish, we are going to turn the Philippines over to the Filipino people. Keep that in mind as we're going through this. So at the end of the day, then, Commodore George Dewey defeats the Spanish, and then the army begins to prepare to come over. And Aguinaldo is sitting, he's actually in Singapore for a while, and then he's in Hong Kong. Some of the people around him that had planned this insurrection against the Spanish have basically exiled themselves to Hong Kong. And it's there that we get to know him. And the basic view of him is he is an honest, sincere, and natural leader of men. So back to Manila Bay. It is an excellent port. And from the north, where Corregidor is, all the way to the south, this is a key port in the area. And this is why the Assistant Secretary of Navy, Teddy Roosevelt, has his eye on it. It is the most strategically located place in Asia, and it has got great port facilities. And it actually looked like it might be easily defendable. So at the end of the day, this is an absolute rout of the Spanish Navy. The Spanish Navy is virtually destroyed. Here are the three admirals that over this four-year time period will be in charge. And the only one you probably have heard of is Commodore Dewey. But there is a constant Navy presence in the Philippines. And that constant Navy presence will stay there till 1991, when we will be asked to leave our bases. There are four Army officers who will lead the effort over the years. And I put these folks up there with pictures of their days from the Civil War, the American Civil War. They start out as young officers in that Civil War, and I've got another slide that will tell you how they ended. And you can see, and I want you to feel, these folks are experienced. They're not only experienced in the Civil War, they're experienced against the wars against the Native Americans in the United States. Most of the forces that will be involved will be state regiments that will be formed and brought to San Francisco, California, to the Presidio, and will begin to train, be re-equipped with the weapons, and prepare for the move to the Philippines. Here are the leaders. It will start with Wesley Merritt. You come up to Fort Leavenworth, there's a Merritt Hall. And these are the key battles that he was at. He was made a brevet major general at Appomattox. Thomas Anderson had one of the brigades. Arthur MacArthur, Douglas MacArthur's father, and Brigadier General Green. He did not serve in the Civil War, but you can see his son was on the USS Monitor. And he actually was an observer at the Russo-Turkish War. So these folks have seen war, and they are the senior leadership on the ground in the Philippines. They leave by ship from San Francisco in three different deployments. And so as they're prepared, as they get ready, and as the ships arrive, they will deploy from May to June to the Philippines. What's in the Philippines? Well, Aguinaldo's army is approximately 10 to 20,000. Again, these are his, they're actually a pretty regular force, and they have been trained over time and equipped over time to defeat the Spanish. They had planned their own war against the Spanish. And they were ready, and basically Aguinaldo believed we would be the catalyst for independence in the Philippines. Spanish leadership. Fermin Jardines is the governor general, and they have a relatively small force. They have native troops, but their primary duty was fighting Aguinaldo's counterinsurgency and other counterinsurgencies throughout the islands. So this was not an army that had trained for conventional combat against units whose leadership had fought on the battlefields of the United States during the Civil War. But we are a much better army. The same cannot be said for the Spanish troops that we fought in Cuba. There were several of those troops that were pretty well put together. Here's a list then of the units that will conduct the land operation to take Manila. And you can see it's a mix. 14th United States Infantry, that is a regular infantry company. Or, I'm sorry, regular infantry regiment. 23rd. Then you can see the volunteers, and you can also see most of them are from the West. Why? Well, they were the closest to San Francisco in terms of getting there. The other volunteer units are forming up in Florida that will go into Cuba and later Puerto Rico. So these are the units. Furthest, you know, one east, I guess, is the folks from Pennsylvania. So this is a map. of the battlefield. And as good as these slides are, I will sneak over here. The American forces start in the south. So this is Major General Anderson with a division, and there are two brigades online, Greene and MacArthur. Offshore is Dewey and the Navy ready to prepare to support the land invasion. You can see up here, Aguinaldo's got about 10,000 of his troops. We do not want them in the fight up there in Intramuros. What this does, this river here keeps Aguinaldo's forces from the fight. So what's going to happen is the American forces will move up the coastline and take Intramuros. And Aguinaldo and his troops will be pushed out of the fight and will really not take part at all. That was pre-planned. The Spanish forces and the American forces' leaderships had got together. And so what you have is the mock Battle of Manila. Now, there were several of the National Guard, the state units, that didn't quite get the word, so there were some fatalities and casualties. But the Spanish were just supposed to fire a few shots for face and then surrender. And essentially, that's what did happen. After what Dewey did to their navy at sea, this army was not ready, even though the numbers are about even. But they will surrender. They will surrender only to the Americans. And then the Americans will take care of the Spanish prisoners. They will not be handed over to Aguinaldo or the Philippine forces. Merritt will then leave. He will turn over command to General Otis. So after completing the reduction of the Spanish, we now are about securing the islands. We have not yet said what we're going to do with the islands. So there's some interest in Aguinaldo's group of what we're really going to do. The other thing that's interesting, I found this picture, this little story, that the Japanese were very interested in the Philippines, along with the Germans and others. If you look back at who owned the different territories around the Pacific before World War I, you have a very interesting mix to include the Germans, of course the Brits, and now we're there. And so we land first, but we're going to be watched. We will see the Japanese in the Philippines again. Who is Otis? Very interesting man. You can see he joins early in the war with New York Volunteers, fights at all these different battles, to include the siege at Petersburg. And then he has long service in the American West. He's a Harvard lawyer. And when you go through the officership of the United States Army at this time, you will find that there are quite a few lawyers that had served and had moved up to senior positions in the United States Army. You might ask yourself, why? Well, part of it was in the Civil War, these state regiments were formed, and a lot of them were led by people with political connections. One can argue that after the 4 years of the American Civil War, that the cream rose to the top, that the soldiers rode to the top. It's a meritocracy. I would argue that for the soldiers that fought here, that's what you saw. Now, you don't need to read all of this. I kind of put it in red what you need. This reads like a lawyer. He's asking Aguinaldo, calm down, take a break. We will be getting with you and we will be talking with you, but don't be getting into fights with my soldiers. And this is this interregnum period while back in Washington we're trying to figure out what we're going to do with these islands. There is a huge split in the American populace about this war. It's really split about 50-50. Half are into America's ride to imperialism, and the other half aren't. And this will play itself out by a vote in Congress later. But at the end of the day, Elginaldo is asked by Otis to try to keep the peace. He will move his military forces and his headquarters and hold a Congress at Malolos up north of Manila. So we know where they are. You might also guess what we might do if we decide to go to war with them. This war is going to go from Manila north. And you'll see that's the way it's going to happen. But what's happening on the ground is a peace of sorts. So you can see U.S. and Filipino police guarding Intramuros together. We put a perimeter out around that's manned only by U.S. troops, and we will patrol Manila. This patrolling of Manila is what we would call today stability operations. And it is working relatively well for a while. Back in Washington, a treaty is about to be signed with the Spanish. So the Treaty of Paris is signed in 10 December. In that treaty, we buy the Philippines from them for about, I think, $22 million. This word goes back to the Philippines. And the rumblings of a new conflict are abound. We declare we're going to do benevolent assimilation. What a wonderful idea. We'll talk about that in a few minutes. We have a period from December to February waiting for Congress to decide whether or not to ratify the treaty. And they will ratify the treaty. Up here you see Mark Twain and Andrew Carnegie. They are leading the charge against it. We don't want to be a colonial power. We don't want to be the imperialists in Asia. And those are two leading figures. However, on the 4th and 5th of February, the night of the 4th to the morning of the 5th, a Nebraska volunteer hears some noises on this bridge, thinks there may be an incursion, and fires. And for all intents and purposes, this starts the war with Elginaldo's conventional forces. Navy's there to help, immediately making sure Elginaldo's forces cannot buy weapon systems from overseas, buy arms. They will also help the Army conduct amphibious operations, and the naval gunfire is always available when it's within range. They also will allow headquarters and logistics support aboard ship. So the Navy plays a vital role in this. I found a Navy postgraduate school master's thesis that was full of great information on the Navy's role in this war, in this set of conflicts. So what were they armed with? This is the first generation after the Civil War. The regular soldiers have the Krag, the 3040 Krag Jorgensen. And the line is civilize them with a Krag. What the state regiments had was the 4570 trapdoor. It's still used early on, powder that... Yeah, smokeless powder for the Krag, not smokeless powder. They could be seen. But the slug from this Springfield it kills elephants. You can see that it's larger than that. We have field guns, so we have artillery, and we have the Gatling guns as well. So we outclass Elginaldo's guerrillas significantly in the armaments that we have. And the Navy, with its blockade, is preventing anybody from supporting them. We also are innovative. We talk to our students about innovation and how important innovation is in any war. And you innovate depending upon the enemy you're fighting, the terrain you're fighting in, and all those other vagaries of war. So the American soldiers were innovating. There was a railroad that went north to Malolos, and we were using that. And we had to repair it. We had to keep it in repair. You can see bridging. And we were still a cavalry army at that time. So we built cavalry. Signal Corps, we're starting to see better and better equipment for being able to communicate. And at the end of the day, we'll put the Utah Light Artillery on some gunboats that we can use on the rivers. None of this is really foreseen going in there, but it develops as innovations over time. Who else is there? The old building that housed CGSC was called Bell Hall. It was named for J. Franklin Bell. And he started out as a major intel officer. And he was very, very good at his job. Buffalo Soldiers. We have the 24th Infantry and the 9th Cavalry. So for those of you that know, there's a 24th and a 25th, and there's a 9th and the 10th. There's a statue to the 10th at Fort Leavenworth. These were black regiments with white officers. And they were in the Philippines fighting beside us. They're best known, the Buffalo Soldiers, for the fight against the Native Americans in the West. So they were well known by the leadership of the Army because they had worked beside them for a long period of time. We also did some mounted infantry. Now, there's other people in here that can talk to the difference between cavalry, dragoons, and mounted infantry. And if that question comes up, I'll point to a couple people in the back. But at the end of the day, we're building our own dragoons because the roads in the Philippines are not good. The terrain is not good. But we have to be able to outmaneuver Aguinaldo's forces, who generally know the area better than we do. So we are always worried about mobility. And so between the trains for logistic mobility, which we used extensively in the American Civil War, we want to use those where we can in the Philippines. So here are the Revolutionary Regulars. And then you can see the first South Dakota Volunteers. At the end of the day, when you read the stories of this, and I've got a couple of books at the end that I'll recommend to you, the Filipino forces tend to shoot high. And they really weren't known for their marksmanship. And part of that is, marksmanship is about practice shooting. And if you don't have much ammunition, and ammunition is dear to you, then you're not going to get the practice that you need. And if there's one thing the United States could produce, it's ammunition. And so what you have is a very outclassed force. Here are the official campaigns. And I just want you to see, this takes about a year. And you can see from the numbers on the map where most of the fighting took place. So it is about the island of Luzon. The Philippines is still about the islands of Luzon. But we fought in Samar. We fought in Mindanao. We have to take all of the islands and secure them over time. But this initial year, in a generally conventional fight against Aguinaldo's forces, it's mostly up. And you can see that we are fighting all over Luzon. And you can see from the timing that it's a back and forth. Part of that is fighting during rainy seasons. You have to back up, fall back on your logistics lines, reform, refit. So we were taking some places back and forth. What did this look like then? By the end of the year, it's becoming a mix of conventional war against El Guanado's conventional forces, but the guerrilla war is beginning. And as in most guerrilla wars, destroying the logistics lines of your enemy is a great idea. And as you can see here, one of our trains gets blown up. These guys are regulars. You can tell because they're the ones with the crags. You can also see down there the terrain, the swamps and the forests. This will also cause a great amount of disease among the Americans that are there. William Howard Taft, he becomes the head of the Philippine Commission in March of 1900. He chafes under having to work for the military. And there's a political battle going back and forth to Washington, D.C. over who's going to control the operations on the island. And at this point in time, Taft has to work for the Army. And as a guy that's later going to be president, that's not his favorite thing to do. He will become the civil governor of the Philippines and will essentially take over. As you can see, his fellow bureaucrats that we put into the island are readying themselves for the mission of taking over the Philippines. So who's MacArthur? So we've had Merritt, we've had Otis, and now we get MacArthur. And like father, like son, he is a fighting general. And he immediately wants to go on the offensive and stay on the offensive. So he becomes the commanding general and the governor general, and he and Taft do not get along at all. And so it's a tough year for Taft. So at the end of the day, MacArthur then is on this island for long service. You saw him in the brigade that took Intramuros. Then he has the division. Then he becomes the military governor. One of his regimental commanders is a man from Kansas, Colonel Funston. If you come up to Fort Leavenworth, you will see Funston Hall. And so the very famous, he is really a soldier of fortune in uniform. He fought in Cuba. He's another fighting man. In the middle of this, the Boxer Rebellion happens in China. And the forces from the Philippines will join forces coming in from the mainland United States to conduct the 55 days at Peking. Some of you may have been here when I did the movie 55 Days at Peking. So this is the American commander of the U.S. forces that did the 55 days at Peking. And you can see the different units that were involved. They are all regular units. There are no state units that were involved in this. So this is sending one of the best commanders, Chaffee, with some of the best forces. But this comes out of MacArthur's hide, and he's not very happy about it. Because these forces that were in the Philippines were some of his best forces, and they were needed to continue the fight in the Philippines. We're running out of forces. We've been there now over a year. The American people want, the states want their states' units back home. And so what are we going to do? We have to replace the state militia regiments. So we will come up with the bright idea of having United States volunteer infantry regiments. Not state, federal, but not regular army. So the 14th is regular army. And you can see these guys in the wonderful uniforms are one of the new volunteer regiments. And we will increase the size of forces in the Philippines significantly. Now, I'll make a comment. Fighting an insurgency is more manpower intensive than fighting a war against a conventional enemy. In order to spread, to take out the rest of the islands, we needed to double the force we had in the Philippines. It wasn't going to come out of the state militias. So it had to come out of more regular forces. And that's why the United States Volunteer Infantry Regiments were formed. We begin now to see what you should see if you are increasing your forces. The other guy surrenders. So there are mass surrenders of Aguinaldo's forces, which is good, except the holdovers will then begin to fight guerrilla war. And guerrilla war is much more manpower intensive for us because it's spread all over the islands. In the meantime, we're trying to do, again, what's now called stability operations. Clear, hold, build. Well, what do you build? You have to build a society. And those few guys in white coats are not going to be the bureaucracy of the Philippines. I have to build a Philippine bureaucracy made up of those educated people in the Philippines. And so I have got to build everything. To start with, though, something that we learned was we're going to have soldiers that are the public administrators, and you're going to see one of them later who's a judge, economic advisors, organizers, and trainers. We've got to build a police force. And one of the police forces that we'll build over time is called the Philippine Constabulary, which will be one of the more famous forces that gets built there. And then the justices and lawyers. So MacArthur knows it's not just the fight. It has to be a whole-of-government approach. Now, you might ask yourself, if we're so good at this here, what happened in Iraq and Afghanistan? Don't ask. We knew how to do this. We know how to do this. It's in our history. So we can save that question for the end, and then I'll call on some of my colleagues so I don't get myself in too much trouble. These are then the carrots. Things that we're trying to do so that the Filipino people will appreciate, even though we bought the Philippines from the Spanish and we took over for the Spanish, we're not going to rule like the Spanish. If you study the Spanish-American War and what went on in Cuba, you'll see how bad the Spanish rule was. So we were trying to show the Philippine people that we were going to be better rulers than they'd had before. However, what happens when they don't play the game? What you're going to see in this war is war crimes. Several officers were court-martialed for what we would now call war crimes. The water cure, waterboarding, was done. Summary executions were done. We would burn down villages that supported guerrillas. We'd relocate people. The other thing that you might look at is, what are the Brits doing in South Africa in the Boer War? What is happening around the world at about the same time in different colonial places? Where did we get this from? Well, this gentleman here, James H. Blunt, starts off as an officer in a volunteer unit, but he stays and becomes a judge. And this, the American occupation of the Philippines, this is the book that you want to, you can find it on the internet and you can read it, because he is very harsh about the mistakes that we made on that island, on those islands. And he was very much against it. But you've got to go back to what we did in the Civil War, in our own Civil War, and then what we did with the Native Americans. We rounded them up. We put on reservations. We burned down their villages. It was part of the ethos of the time. Even though it was beginning to emerge that this was not the way to win the hearts and minds of the Filipino people. We will increasingly try to use Filipinos to control, manage their fellow citizens. And some of these will have a long history. The Filipino scouts will become famous in World War II. The Maccabees Scouts will help Funston in an episode that happens a little bit later. And then you can see the U.S. officers that were basically the leadership of the Philippine Scouts. We have a program now that sort of tries the same thing. We want an advisor system where we can put advisors in to help train. Sometimes it's special forces. More often than not now, it's conventional soldiers in these security assistance brigades. And they will provide senior leadership to native peoples if needed. That's not a good term for it anymore. With those national armies that could use our help. And it may not be to train them to do basic military skills. What we're now looking for is if we fight beside them, they will know what we're doing, we'll know what they're doing, we're sharing communications, and we're working together. So we're sharing communications and we're working together. And it goes everything from the people of Manila to these tribes that were back in the jungle areas of the Philippines. We have to take all of the Philippines, not just living in Manila and having a good time in Luzon. We've got to move south and secure the other islands. This is Funston, graduated of Iola High School and the University of Kansas. And at the end of the day, he will work with the Maccabees Scouts, and they will capture El Guinaldo in his camp. It wasn't exactly a military operation. It was more of what some people would say was a crime. They basically dressed up like the natives, guerrilla groups, snuck into the camp by subterfuge, and captured El Guinaldo. This essentially will end the insurgency in the Philippines. We have El Guinaldo. You can see he's being moved to the USS Vicksburg. And you can also see that Funston doesn't mind having his picture taken with him. Again, El Guinaldo was highly thought of. We knew we were fighting an intelligent man with an operation that was very difficult. So we have it. This is Funston with some of his Filipino scouts that helped capture him. Oh, I'm sorry. On the map, why did I put that? You can see this is where El Guinaldo was captured. And you can see the terrain to the north. In World War II, the war will end against Japan before the United States will complete the capture of the northern part of Luzon. And some of you may remember the last Japanese soldier in the Philippines surrendered in 1973. Would have liked to have had his back pay. So at the end of the day, we get El Guinaldo, and for all intents and purposes, the key leadership of the Philippine insurgency is now gone. Interesting book by a guy named Max Boot called The Savage Wars of Peace. And he argues, especially about looking at this, that we are actually very good at small wars, these savage wars of peace. Now, what we have to do is move from large units, divisions, brigades, regiments, to much smaller units, companies and below. We will put over 500 outposts out there. This is reminiscent of General Petraeus moving the troops off the FOBs, forward operating bases, out into the communities of Iraq. We will later try it as well in Afghanistan. It is the next step. The trouble is, it's dangerous. Charlie Company of the 9th U.S. Infantry gets attacked one morning at breakfast. 44 of them are killed, brutally murdered by BOLOs. And at the end of the day, the 9th Infantry Regiment will go in to Balangiga and get revenge. We will steal the bells from the Catholic Church. Oh, acquire them, I'm sorry. We'll acquire them. We will actually give them back in about 2000. We'll fly them back in and give them back. The ninth nickname for the ninth is the Manchus. They're a regiment that served in China, and they did not let the people of this area get away with it, and it causes some real problems in terms of war crimes. On the 2nd of July, a directive from Roosevelt that says the United States Army will turn over the leadership in the Philippines to the civilian authorities. So the Philippine colony is now under civilian control. MacArthur is gone. He's replaced by Adna Chaffee, who's the guy that led the 14th Infantry into China during the Boxer Rebellion. But for all intents and purposes, MacArthur's now off the island, and the last administrator is here. This is Roosevelt on Memorial Day 1902, and it will be declared in July that the war is over, and we'll have a victory parade. Now, everybody that's in here should know the war's not over. We have been working with the Filipinos against different guerrilla organizations until yesterday. But at the end of the day, we had a period off, and then right after 9/11, we formed and went back in. And I'll talk about some of those. But this is the official end of the war in the Philippines. 1899 to 1903, a new guy's going to show up. A Missouri boy, John J. Pershing. Notice the timing. 1913, he's there. 1916, he's going into Mexico. 1917, he's leading the American Expeditionary Force into France. So this gentleman that you see is noted for how well he established control and stability in Zamboanga, which is all the way down in Mindanao. So the reputation of Pershing grows. Where does it start? Arguably here. Let me skip ahead now to the Second World War. In the Second World War, this is, I'll let you read this statement by Douglas MacArthur. When General Skinny Wainwright surrendered to the Japanese at Corregidor, all American forces in the Philippines were ordered to surrender to the Japanese. A group of Americans said, not me. Volkman was one of them. Volkman said, I don't know what's going to happen after the war. I might get a medal, or I might be court-martialed for disobeying a direct order. So Volkman is the U.S. guy on the ground that will help lead this. Those Filipino guerrillas, the grandson, the sons and grandsons of El Guinaldo, will form five infantry regiments to help us fight the Japanese. In 1936, we had promised the Filipinos that they would have their independence in 1946. It was a 10-year period of commonwealth, but they knew that they would get their independence. So at the end of the day, then, what we have is the U.S. Army in the Philippines. The United States Army forces in the Philippines, that's the patch that they made up, and they will begin to do great service to the United States Army as we're trying to take back North Luzon. There are scouts, and they are a significant help to us. This is the legacy of what you should be seeing, this legacy. This is a very complex legacy, but we're very much intertwined. Today, not today, but in 91, we were asked to leave the bases. I was just leaving U.S. Indo-PACOM, the headquarters in Hawaii. I didn't believe that we'd ever give up Clark Air Force Base, Subic Bay, and QB Point. Navy facilities, Air Force facilities. And then there was a range that we used. But the Filipino people, through their Senate, in a vote that I think was 20-16, said, we no longer need you on the island. And we left. I guess the lesson there is, be careful what you ask for. But then again, you can also see that we didn't treat the Filipino people all that well. So, they wanted their independence for real. No U.S. forces on their soil, and we left. And then what we start to see is a series of internal problems. The CPP-NPA, the Communist Party, the Philippines, the New People's Army, that begins in 1946 with something called the Hukbalapap. They were never going to give up a guerrilla fight. So they could fight beside us one day against the Japanese and against us a week later. So there is a Communist Party of the Philippines and there is a Philippine insurgent group. The remnants are still there. Then you have the Moro National Liberation Front, and there are several others with those, the MILF. There's different names for the different Muslim groups down in Mindanao. And we have fought against them. And then Abu Sayyaf. There was a preacher and his wife from Kansas who were, he was killed and she was kidnapped for a while. And then this is Abu Sayyaf. These groups still exist. It's hard to wipe out any insurgent group. We were invited back in something called, it was basically a global war on terrorism offshoot that we did in the Philippines, JSOTF-P, Joint Special Operations Task Force Philippines. And so we went back in there right after 9/11, and we have been working with the Filipinos ever since in a very quiet manner with the Filipinos in the lead. And I think it worked. This is the father, and that's the son. In the meantime, we have seen what you would have to argue is a move towards greater and greater democracy in the Philippines. It was a bit of a surprise to see Marcos come back, but then again, the Marcos family has always been an important family in the Philippines on the island of Luzon. So he's back, and surprisingly, working well with us. So, General Austin visits in 2023. They agree to a larger U.S. presence. If you're watching the news, you see, probably on a weekly basis, some sort of incursion by the Chinese against Philippine-claimed territory in the South China Seas. And the United States Navy is helping, but the United States, other parts of the U.S. military are there. What he has said is, these bases in the Philippines are for the Americans to help the Filipinos. They're not bases for you to mount operations to defend Taiwan. So there are always strings attached. We'll see how that goes over time. So far, it's been going swimmingly, and we were offered more base access. What's the problem? The South China Sea. Outlined in yellow on that map are what's claimed by the Philippines. What the Chinese claim is everything. It was a 9-dash line, it's now a 10-dash line. They moved the line, and they added another part to the line, and now it goes to the east of Taiwan, as you can see on here. So, last week, you saw Coast Guard cutters from China, and they crashed into a Philippine ship. So, this is a dangerous area. We have a mutual defense treaty with the Philippines. We have signed that we will help them defend their territory. The only real threat to Philippine territory is the Chinese, or are the Chinese. So at the end of the day, our ships are always in the area, for all intents and purposes. The Chinese Coast Guard has got bigger, meaner, uglier, and more aggressive over time. And we've been trying to help the Philippines build a navy, mostly to protect their fishing fleets, because that's where the biggest clashes are coming right now. It's about fishing. But for the Chinese, it's about sovereignty. What should you read? Brian McAllister Lynn, I think, is still at Texas A&M. This is a great book on the Philippine War. Notice they start 89 and they start 89. Nobody wants to talk much about the war against the Spanish in 1898. It basically starts, the war is 89 on. So you got McAllister Lynn's book, which is very detailed. And then you got the Shelby book, which is a nice afternoon read, but he covers it very well. So these were the two books that I would recommend to you. And then I'll give you a poster that should bring back old memories. We took the Philippines for humanity's sake. So you've seen the benevolent assimilation of the Philippines. I'm now open to your questions.
I think we got about 10 minutes for questions at the microphones.
My question's a bit of a sideshow, but I've always been curious about it. The remnants of the Spanish that were in the Philippines after the war, once we became involved in fighting the Filipinos, put down their insurrection, did the Spanish that were still there, and I suspect there was some there, remnant of the Spanish, did they support the United States or did they support the Filipinos?
To the best of my knowledge, they supported us because we protected them. So it was kind of a tit for tat. If you'll protect us from El Guanado's henchmen, then we're going to get along. The other thing is, like in a lot of places, the Spanish were some of the bureaucrats, and some were well-liked, and some of them did a good job. So as far as I know, we took care of them, and then slowly over time, they were either protected and then sent back to Spain, or, you know, like a lot of the European powers, you tend to marry into the local families and stay there. So I have no idea what the numbers are of how that worked, but those Spanish had been there since Magellan, so it had been a while.
But you pretty well say they were on our side, pretty much, the Spanish.
Pretty much, yep.
Okay, thank you.
Or like most people, they're on their own side.
Well, yeah.
Yes, ma'am.
The guerrilla warfare that was done in the Philippines, was that of any help to us in Vietnam?
I'm sorry, which type of war?
So the guerrilla warfare we fought in the Philippines, was that of any help in Vietnam?
All right, so this is going to be filmed, and I work for the Army. I got to say, these are Jeff Babb's opinions, not of the United States Army, the United States government, or the Commanding General Staff College. We don't learn anything. We have a real problem with lessons learned. I mean, arguably, we seem to be doing better right now watching the Ukrainians and learning from what's going on there. And I'm being a bit unfair. There's always a part of the Army that will try to dig out the lessons learned, that at least be lessons observed. But the other problem you have with insurgencies are there what we call sui generis. They're all significantly different. So if you're looking for a cookie-cutter solution to COIN, You can't go find one. Sir.
Good evening. Thank you for your excellent presentation. My name is Dr. Manuel Pardo. I am a native of Manila in the Philippines and has been a resident of Kansas City for over 50 years now.
I remember you because I have made an untoward remark about General MacArthur that you took me to task over, and I'm glad you did. So I'm sure this will be another good question.
I was just going to say I was a bit disappointed that you made no mention of the role of the so-called Thomasites. They were a bunch of volunteer teachers who came to the Philippines and helped in promoting the so-called benevolent assimilation. Because the country went from war to peace with the role of the Thomasites playing a big part in it. They introduced the English language. They introduced the school system.
Do you remember what years they came, when they were there?
About not long after the 1898 era. And of local interest is one of the Thomasites was a gentleman from Independence, Missouri, whose name is George Biggs. He was a president of Graceland College in Independence for many years. So I just wanted to add the role of the Thomasites in making the Philippines an English-speaking country.
That's very interesting. Again, there's a whole other presentation that somebody could do on missionaries in Asia. I'm more familiar with China than missionaries that came in here, but they were huge. In 1984, when I was traveling around China as a army officer in training, there were 80 people from Oral Roberts University teaching English in China and using Bibles as the textbooks. So the missionary movement in Asia is huge. I'm most familiar with that in China, but that's great information, and I'm not surprised, because I had on my slide that it's the soldiers that are the teachers and the others, but civilians obviously were coming in to help. So thank you very much, sir.
The local saying in the Philippines, 500 years under Spain was like 500 years in the convent. And 50 years of the Americans was like 50 years in Hollywood.
That's a great line.
Thank you.
Thank you, sir. Yeah.
What were the Japanese thinking or doing during this period?
There's a Japanese expert in the back, so he can stand up. And after the Russo-Japanese War, 1904-05, the United States Navy finally figured out that the Japanese are going to be the future enemy. And so there's an argument that the first Plan Orange that the United States developed for a future fight with Japan starts in 1906. It was probably a little bit later. But then, at that time, in 1902, the Japanese Navy was being advised by the British Navy. The British Navy was the Japanese Navy's model. And so our Navy knew we were in trouble. But we are allies with the Japanese through World War I. But then it slowly begins to deteriorate, especially after 1931. when they take over Manchuria and then form the puppet state of Manchukuo. So it will be a slow, steady burn from 1906 to 1941.
Thank you.
Hey, we got time for one more, or we're done?
Yep, thank you very much, as always.
My pleasure.